You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We wish to assure the nation that His Excellency the President of the Republic of Zimbabwe and Commander-in-Chief of the Zimbabwe Defence Forces, Comrade R.G. Mugabe, and his family are safe and sound, and their security is guaranteed. We are only targeting criminals around him who are committing crimes that are causing social and economic suffering in the country in order to bring them to justice.
Is a coup not a coup if the guy with his tanks parked on the president's lawn says it isn't a coup? My guests Daniela Pellard and Carol Walker will be discussing a remarkable day in Zimbabwe and the day's other top stories, including Australia's eventual doing of the decent thing vis-a-vis same-sex marriage, the latest efforts to affix wheels to the Brexit wagon, and is the Republican Party, what with one thing and another, in any position to give lessons in how not to commit sexual harassment? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellard, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and the political analyst, Carol Walker. Welcome both. Now, first of all, there has not been a coup d'etat in Zimbabwe. This, at least, was the line taken by a uniformed officer who appeared on state television shortly after his troops seized the station and their comrades deployed on the streets of the capital in armoured personnel carriers, soundtracked by the occasional crackle of gunfire. Major General Sibusiso Moyo, for it was he, insisted that the military was merely after criminals of unspecified type, and that Zimbabwe's interminable president, Robert Mugabe, had been placed under house arrest for his own safety. Daniela, this does look a bit like a coup d'etat, doesn't it?
Well, if it looks like a coup and it sounds like a coup, then... But I suppose it's the classic thing for people carrying out a coup to say, well, this is not a coup. We're just protecting people, and the president is safe, and all will go... on as usual. I mean, I'm just surprised why this has taken so long to happen. There have been coups precipitated by much, much less. When you think, was it nearly 40 years now of massive mismanagement, corruption and devastation of Zimbabwe's economy? And also an extremely, I don't want to be ageist here, but an extremely, extremely old man at the head of all of this.
If one in vexingly good shape. I was broadly in the vicinity of Robert Mugabe some years ago at the, I think it was the 50th anniversary celebrations of the establishment of Swaziland. I think that was it. It was in Swaziland. They were celebrating something or other, and Mugabe was there already at that point, obviously about 110 years old, and I did see him leap up a staircase three at a time.
You didn't see what happened afterwards, though, did
no,
you?
Well, no, well, this is a fair point.
Yeah, one of the leading British MPs, Nicholas Soames, met him just a couple of weeks ago and said that for a man of 93, he was remarkably on top of events, though he did seem rather tired, which is perhaps not surprising at the age of 93.
Carol, do we assume that somewhere behind what is going on in Zimbabwe, and obviously that is far from a clear picture at the moment, that there is the hand of the sacked vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who, having been dispensed with, has struck back at his patron?
Well, there is still a lot of confusion, but it does look as though Emmerson Mnangagwa, the crocodile as he's known, has snapped back, having been booted out of his job. And it does seem as though the military have decided that he is the man to take over the reins of power. The signals coming from South Africa seem to suggest that President Zuma also thinks that it would be better for Zimbabwe if the crocodile was in power instead of Gucci Grace, Robert Mugabe's wife, much his junior, who has irritated many people in the country.
Well, just about all of them, by all accounts.
By her champagne quaffing as they struggle to make ends meet.
Grace Mugabe, the First Lady, did appear, Daniela, to fancy herself as her husband's successor. Her present whereabouts are a matter of some conjecture. There is some suggestion that she has climbed aboard an aeroplane, doubtless with as much of the national treasury as she could carry, and left the country. That doesn't really reinforce the idea that this is the military acting on the president's behalf, just trying to keep things safe, secure and orderly, does it?
No, absolutely. But in that, as in many other respects, this does seem to be unfolding like a coup. Similarly, the fact that South Africa and the international community in general seem to be hedging their bets and waiting to see which way things...
You don't get the impression there's a lot of people going, please, let this not be the end for Robert Mugabe.
No, exactly. But it's still very unclear what might happen now. Is he going to be shifted off to some sort of purely ceremonial role, or is he going to be pursued as... Is there going to be a process of justice, which seems rather unlikely given his age and given the disruption that might entail? And will there be elections now as well? And how will that work out? The Morgan Tsvangirai, who once had briefly shared power with Mugabe, is, as I understand, returning to the country, although he's not in good health either. So will there be an election with a vigorous opposition contending, or is this a transfer of power?
Carol, what are Robert Mugabe's retirement options at this point?
Well, what is interesting will be to see whether a way can be found to properly ease him out of power and what will happen to him. I was hearing on my way in a senior figure in the country saying that he believed that Robert Mugabe, if he relinquished the reigns with some dignity, could be allowed a peaceful retirement in the country. But that does beg the question as to what would happen to his wife. As you mentioned, Grace Mugabe clearly had ambitions to take over the reins of power. There are many people in the country who would not be happy about that. This is a woman who went around snapping up prime properties in South Africa and buying a new Rolls Royce when many civil servants hadn't been paid for months and months. And I think there has to be a big question mark over that. Robert Mugabe and many of his entourage are still subject to international travel bans and sanctions. So I think there are still questions as to what's going to happen here. And also, we haven't yet heard from Mugabe himself as to whether he is actually, after all this time, simply going to step aside and go into a nice peaceful retirement somewhere. And I think that we also have to bear in mind that the reputation of Mnangagwa is hardly stain-free. There are questions over, his past, and many people in the country, of course, will simply want to know whether somebody will take over who can put the economy back on its feet and end some of the terrible trail of corruption and repression which they've had to cope with for so many years.
But it's also worth remembering that elections are due next year. In any case, so I mean, I think we have passed the point. It seems impossible to see any way in which Grace Mugabe is going to come back and run a political campaign. I don't think that she's got much popular backing, or her husband is going to participate in next year's election. Because whatever happens, this is enormously damaging for his status. And I think the question is now whether he'll be allowed to go into retirement, whether he'll be prosecuted, or whether he'll gracefully bow out. But I think there will be calls both domestically and internationally for proper democratic process, and that perhaps a holding pattern until next year, but for elections to go ahead.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Australia, my homeland, which, though it has done it far too late and by the most absurd, mean-spirited and undignified means possible, has legalised marriage for same-sex couples. Or rather, will do, following the announcement that in a voluntary postal plebiscite, 61.6% of a 79.5% turnout said yes. For the love of God, yes, are we still even talking about this? I paraphrase somewhat. It means that Australia will just about fall into the first 30 countries to have undertaken this exercise in elementary decency and bring a merciful close to a debate which may have represented a new low in the country's civic discourse. I don't know why I put "may" in that sentence. It totally represented a new low in Australia's civic discourse. Carol, first of all, from an outsider's point of view, knowing what you might of Australia, does it seem weird, because it sure as hell does to me, that it's taken Australia this long?
Well, it does, and I think it's definitely a positive move that Australia has seen the light and decided to sanction same-sex marriage. We've had it in this country, but it's worth remembering in the UK, same-sex marriage was introduced by David Cameron back in 2014. I remember sitting in the conference hall as he announced it to his party that he was going to back it with this great flourish, an announcement that was met with a deafening silence from many of the very conservative members who were listening to him. So it's not that long that it's been in place here. And it was interesting to note that many European countries, including Italy, Switzerland, Greece, and of course Northern Ireland, still don't recognise same-sex marriage. So it is certainly, I think, welcome that Australia has taken this step. I think it is a step that will perhaps change some of the perceptions that many people outside the country do have of Australians. And let's hope that it prompts many of those other countries who have yet to recognise this to follow the lead that Australia is setting. Fascinating to think that on social policy, Australia is ahead of the Swiss.
Only just, unfortunately. Daniela, I was, to declare a position here, among those who thought that the plebiscite option was a terrible, terrible, terrible idea, not least because it would just turn into the circus that it did. Is there anything to be said for that idea? I mean, I can see that on the one hand, you do get this indisputable endorsement by a big majority of people saying this is the kind of country we want to be. On the other hand, I just think it's weird to put the civil rights of a minority up for debate by the majority to be sort of awarded or removed at the whim of their fellow citizens.
Well, I think there's place for these kinds of measures. I mean, I think the idea of a plebiscite is kind of bonkers, and it was a postal vote, as it were,
was.
Which took 2 months. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You can look at the experience of Ireland, which had a referendum 2 years ago, and there, I mean, strangely, considering the previous power of the Catholic Church, similar voting ratio, about 60% in favour and 40% against. So I think if you're going to make these massive social changes in, I think both countries have got a strong conservative element, there's something to be said for a referendum, but a postal vote, and now the process has to go through Parliament.
Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister, says he is going to do as expeditiously as possible, possibly even before Christmas. But Carol, Malcolm Turnbull is now, of course, trying to claim credit for Australia doing this. Politicians is, of course, in their nature to try and claim credit for things that happen on their watch, and frankly, on Turnbull so far, very little else has. But does he deserve any? He is the person who could have said, you know, dag nabbit, I'm the Prime Minister, this is the right thing to do and we're doing it. But he didn't. I mean, obviously the political reasons for that are clear enough, that he has a sort of dingbat conservative wing of his party that he has to be concerned about. But really, is he allowed to get out in front of this and say, yay, I'm great?
Well, he probably feared a reception like the one that David Cameron got at his party conference. And clearly he was anxious not to take on some of those more conservative elements within his own party and within the country. And I'm sure that there will be people, perhaps in more remote parts of Australia, dare I say it, who won't be happy about this move. It does seem a bit of a ducking of responsibility to put it out there in a referendum. But, you know, that's what David Cameron did when it comes to Europe. And look where that led us with the Brexit referendum. So people have different views of referendums. Personally, I think, you know, if you have a representative democracy, then those who are elected should put forward the policies that they think are right, and then try to shape public opinion accept the consequences when they get it wrong. But let's just say that in this case, the great Australian public have shown that they are enlightened, that this is what they want their politicians to do. And you showed us just before we came on air a wonderful picture on the front page of the
Geelong Advertiser. It is a ripper. I do recommend our listeners look it up. But they've discovered a couple of gay plumbers in Geelong who are now planning to get married, but photographed them, I think, dressed half in formal wear and half in workwear. It's the boots that make it, I think.
And I think it is worth remembering that there are more than 70 countries around the world where homosexuality is still outlawed. So good for Australia for taking this step. And let's hope for a bit more enlightenment in some of those other countries where gay people face a really, really difficult time.
Daniela, just for fun, the No campaign. Obviously, the problem they face, not that I'm consumed with sympathy for them, is that you can't really run a campaign in this day and age saying, we're just cranks and bigots and we don't like gay people and that's why we're against this. So they did try to frame this as a religious freedom issue. Any sale?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I may be unpopular for saying this, but I do have some sympathy for them. And that's another reason why I think a referendum is not such a clumsy instrument for efforts such as these. I mean, obviously, I think it's a no-brainer. Clearly, all people of good faith and conscience, apart from religious people, maybe, would support gay marriage. But I think, practically speaking, amidst serious social change like this, you have to have buy-in from the general public, and it helps to people are involved and feel they have a chance to also make their objections felt as well. I think the result was a fantastic one, and the proportions, as I said, don't particularly surprise me coming after the experience of Ireland. But yeah, religious people hold an awful lot of kind of strange, quite strange and eccentric, in my opinion, ideas, but there has to be room for them to be able to express that as well.
The point being, of course, that nobody was ever going to stop them expressing them.
But it also has legal implications when it comes to, you know, you're going to march into a synagogue or a church and say, I want to get married to my boyfriend or my girlfriend. And will the church or synagogue then have to go along with it? I mean, that's a whole other kettle of fish. But that is for the legislators to bash out.
And it is worth remembering that in the UK, when same-sex marriage was introduced, a specific exemption was included, which allowed the churches to say whether or not they would agree to it happening actually within their church.
I mean, I wish the religions were as liberal and open-minded, as progressive as other people, but that's just a fact of life.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Malott, along with Daniela Pellet and Carol Walker. Coming up next, Britain's serene glide to the sunlit uplands of Brexit continues.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing Bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and Carol Walker. Now, it is give or take 499 days and 4 hours until the United Kingdom leaves the European Union. And one of the reasons we know this is that the UK's government is attempting to enshrine this moment of departure in law, as if its negotiating position wasn't already sufficiently hamstrung. However, the government has encountered opposition to this and other things from several of its own MPs. The Daily Telegraph has helpfully depicted all of them on its front page this morning under the reasonable, proportionate and not at all insane headline, The Brexit Mutineers. Carol, they are of course now scrutinising the bill, the EU withdrawal bill. How's it going?
Oh, it's all sweetness and light. Potential rebels are being described as mutineers who are collaborating with the
Is mutiny
enemy.
Worse than saboteurs? I lose track. It sounds like it's been scaled down a bit.
It's slightly politer.
The Leave campaign decided to calm things down by calling them traitors. So on the other side, we've had one of those who were on the other side of the argument, potential rebels, describing Theresa May's latest amendment as mad, accusing the opponents of trying to bully them. But so far this week, Theresa May has not managed to lose any cabinet ministers. She's not lost a vote yet.
But hang on.
And she survived Prime Minister's question time. So we've got to Wednesday.
It's only Wednesday.
So this counts as a good week for Theresa May. Essentially what's happening here, this EU withdrawal bill was supposed to be a straightforward device to bring all those laws that are currently governed by EU treaties and rules into UK law, so that once Brexit happens, there is at least a solid legal framework. And the government said it would then decide how to change all these different laws. This was supposed to be a short, straightforward bill. So far, there are well over 400 different amendments put down. Theresa May tried to reassure the Brexiteers by putting down an amendment that would put into the face of the legislation the actual time and the date that the UK was going to leave, 11 o'clock on the 29th of March 2019.
Though there was also an argument over whether this was UK time or Europe time.
Well, we had that argument.
That's a desperately important distinction.
And this was supposed to be dressed up as a concession to reassure Brexiteers, but of course those who want to retain close ties to the EU were then saying, well, hang on a second, what if we're very close to agreement and we just need a little bit longer, and what's going to happen then? One of the potential rebels described this as an ultimatum dressed up as a concession, especially when the Brexit secretary made it clear that his promise that Parliament would get a say on the final deal would only be there and they could have that say. But of course, if they said no to the deal that the government came up with, well, Brexit would happen anyway, so we'd just leave without a deal. So there is anger and fury on all sides. So far, the government has got through one late night session. There's another one tonight, but there are some very difficult potential knife-edge votes next week. And although losing a vote wouldn't necessarily mean resignations for the Prime Minister or for other ministers, if she were to lose a vote, you could get calls for no confidence motions. MPs would then have to decide whether this was the moment that they'd had enough of this catalogue of disasters under Theresa May, or whether actually getting rid of her would just make matters worse.
Well, only 499 days to go. Daniela, that journalistic language, and it's not the first time we've seen it, mutineers, according to The Telegraph, I think saboteurs might have been a Daily Mail coinage. Who is supposed to be impressed by this? It is quite a weird way to talk about people.
Well, this is a little bit domestic British media gossip, but I think that the Telegraph has long trying to be, you know, be a sort of a slightly more upper class version of the Daily Mail, populism with some sort of fancier language in a broadsheet, and I think this has slightly fallen flat, this kind of language. But it's populism again, isn't it? I mean, it's a sign to the levels that political discourse have fallen to in this country. And I mean, I sound very old now, and I am, but I remember slightly more dignified times, and I slightly pity people who are forming their political consciousness now, whereas this is the level of discussion. And politicians, I mean, I say this as an out-and-out mutineer. If I could be a saboteur, I would be. I would do anything to derail Brexit myself and personally. But the politicians, what are they doing? It seems to me quite reasonable for politicians to do in a democracy, and actually doing their job and holding the government, even their own government, to scrutiny. But as Carol said, right now, the situation we're in, every stumble and every mistake and every minor problem is really being viewed in the light of, is this the thing? Is this the final straw that to mix metaphors, upsets the apple cart.
I would just dispute that this fact that in the past our political discourse was always so polite. I mean, I do remember back in John Major's day, which was when I started covering politics, don't forget the word that he uttered against the Eurosceptics. Let me tell you that in some of those debates, those furious debates over a previous EU treaty, the Maastricht Treaty, people got incredibly heated and there were knife-edge votes. What is just worth remembering is in 1993, John Major lost a vote on the Maastricht Treaty. There was a no-confidence motion. He easily survived the no-confidence vote. He called his own leadership contest, back me or sack me. He won that and stayed in power until 1997, when he lost out to Tony Blair in the Labour landslide that year. So we shouldn't quite count the Prime Minister out yet.
No, it is a ceaselessly weird political pub fact about British politics that John Major won a greater share of, or greater number of votes for his party than any Prime Minister in British history. But finally tonight, recent revelations about the abominable behaviour of powerful men in assorted fields have prompted a certain amount of sober reflection on how this was able to occur, which I guess we can call the good news, and rather more self-pitying whining almost exclusively from men who have, with an obtuseness verging on genius, contrived to perceive themselves as the victims. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the US House of Representatives, has announced that all members of Congress and their staff will have to undergo anti-harassment training. It seems unlikely that this obligation will be extended to the Oval Office. Daniela, how keen are we on the spectacle of the Republican Party just now taking the high ground on sexual harassment?
Well, yeah, I'm bowled over, really. And what form is this? You know, is this gonna take? Are they gonna be workshops? Are they gonna share best practice in how not to sexually harass people? I wonder if it's
hold up pictures of the president and say basically don't be like this guy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically don't be an idiot. That's what it boils down to. I wonder if this isn't going to be a purely legal exercise. What you can or cannot do without being sued.
So they can say, look, we've done this, we've taken care of it, we made an effort.
Exactly.
I mean, is there, Carol, any imaginable useful training you can give people beyond just trying not to be a jerk?
It is a fascinating thought, and funnily enough, it's been suggested in the UK at Westminster as well, after the series of allegations of improper sexual behaviour. You do wonder how those lessons might go. Will they all be sat down and told to write out 20 times, I shall not force myself on younger and more junior members of staff when they are telling me to stop behaving like a complete so-and-so? I mean, my children at primary school had lessons in something which here is called PSHE, Personal Health, Social and Economy, and they were taught things like general guidelines and stuff like don't take drugs and behave properly to other people behind you or around you and don't behave improperly at parties. All our lawmakers in the United States and the UK, and maybe quite a few senior people in the film industry, do need to kind of go back to primary school level and learn some basic lessons.
Let's bring journalism into that as well.
But there's been quite a lot of outbursts which are that double weirdness in terms of responses. Like the one where you see the thing, you think, okay, one, how do you even think that? And two, why would you have said it out loud where people can hear you? Sort of talk from some politicians, both in the UK and the US, that I just, you know, won't be able to speak to women anymore in my professional life.
Well, that's it. That's for me, has been one of the most ludicrous parts of this. The idea that, well, flirting is going to be banned. If you can't see the difference, I mean, it seems obvious to me between flirting or even being friendly and sexual harassment of a physical or verbal nature. I mean, maybe the fact that it seems so clear to me and so obscure and such a grey area to so many people working in a number of professions, maybe that's the problem.
It does bring to mind the quote from the late great conservative politician Alan Clark, who said, the problem with unwanted sexual advances is, I don't know if they're unwanted until I try it. And yes, it does.
He was famously terrible.
He was, let's say, notorious for his love of taking out young and generally more junior female members of the office staff, anyone else's office staff who was around. I think that there are still senior, older politicians at Westminster who simply have not caught up with the fact that things have changed, that it is not acceptable to go around groping people. I have to say that in my early time at Westminster, I worked there for well over 20 years, it was absolutely routine at Westminster parties that you would have to wallop some bloke to tell him to keep his hands to himself. I never once dreamt of complaining about it, but that is not something that I have experienced in recent years. It's not something I would expect to experience. You would think most people have simply learnt how to behave.
On that very slightly hopeful note, that brings us to the end of today's show. Carol Walker and Daniela Pellard, thank you both for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Daphne Karnesis and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. Music next at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.